And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the first and the last who was dead and has come to live to life says this, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison, so that you will be tested, and you will have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death.
All right, good afternoon. Share a little bit about the church in Smyrna, the shortest snippet that we have here in the book of at least of these seven churches. A little bit different story than what we heard in Thyatira. But we'll get into it a little bit here. Well, you can see on the map where Smyrna is. So it would be, southwest of Thyatira, where we were at, positioned just north of Ephesus. As Josh had mentioned yesterday, the Roman Emperor Domitian it was during his reign when these letters were written, and we're going to learn a little bit more about Smyrna and their emperor worship that they had dating back well before Domitian was there. But they had become famous and had undertaken worship of Caesar for a long time before Domitian was in rule. And Caesar worship was compulsory oftentimes, or was compulsory in Smyrna. So you can see where they're located. It is a port city. So I'm going to go into some of the historical context of the city itself. So kind of framing things up a little bit similarly to what Rick did. And these are Google images of what the city, some of the ruins that are in the city today. But the name Smyrna itself means sweet smelling and can be seen as a synonym for myrrh. And so when we read a little bit more, or when we see, or the persecution, the tribulation that Smyrna had, it's kind of interesting that something that I read that in order for the perfume to be extracted from myrrh, the bark must be crushed and bruised. So it's a fitting metaphor for the experience that the Church of Smyrna had, that they were being crushed and oppressed and bruised. They faced this bitter persecution, but instead of that persecution destroying them, in fact, they would be able to bring out the sweetness of Jesus and be able to show those who are around them. So to be that sweet-smelling aroma that could be an influence to those around them and show Jesus' character to those that were in their midst. A little bit more about the city. It was known as the ornament of Asia. This is more of a painting drawing of what would look out from the city to the sea. It was noted for its beauty. It had rolling hills that were around it. Had a lot of groves, and it had really well paved streets for the time, and had some beautiful buildings that were there. It was also called the Flower of Asia or the Crown of Asia, and was situated in this harbor at the foot of a large hill, or sometimes called a mountain, Mount Pagos, and it was covered on the hillside with lots of ornate temples and noble buildings at the time. So we'll see that it was a pretty wealthy city because of all the trade that was happening there. At the time, it was one of the few locations in the world that had rectangular blocks and well-planned roads. The greatest of these is a road called the Street of Gold, which began at the Temple of Zeus and ended at the Temple of Cybele, containing the most ornate buildings in the city. It was second in trade only to Ephesus at the time, so another big trade city, and likely had a population of around 200,000 people, from what I could read at the time. It kind of got its start around 1000 BCE, and it thrived for several hundred years before Lydians from Sardis destroyed the town in about 600 BC, and then 250 almost 300 years later, Alexander the Great conquered Smyrna and refounded it then at Mount Pagos again. It does have a long, or had a long and loyal history to Rome leading up to when this letter was written. So closer to, or as early as about 195 BC, it was noted that Smyrna started to foresee the rise of the Roman Empire, and at that point in time built a shrine, a temple, to Roma, the goddess of Rome. So going back almost 300 years before this letter is written, there was already that loyalty to what was going to be the Roman Empire starting to happen. There was one story, I don't know if it was true or not, but when Roman soldiers who were waging war were found out to be in extreme hunger and cold, it was said the people of Smyrna stripped off their own clothes and sent them for a contribution to the war effort. And then Cicero referred to Smyrna as one of our most faithful and our most ancient allies. So they were true Roman, true patriots to the Roman Empire to the core. In 23 BC, Smyrna was given the honor of building a temple to the Emperor Tiberius because of their years of faithfulness to Rome. And then, let's see, they were a leading area of empire worship, or emperor worship, rather. And then in AD 26, there was a contest among multiple cities of Rome, or of Asia, rather, to see who could build, who would build the temple to the godhead Emperor Tiberius. And Smyrna was the winner of that competition. And so they were, they swore their allegiance to Caesar, and as a result, it became a dangerous, was going to become a dangerous location to Christians because of that overall loyalty to Rome and what was going to be happening there for the emperor worship. And in fact, the Romans labeled the Christians as atheists because they did not worship the Roman gods or worship the emperor himself. So it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition there. So then they were also determined to be enemies of the state. As Rick had mentioned in his discussion, there's no, besides the limited amount of information here, we really don't know anything about when the church itself was founded. Could have been people who were in Jerusalem at the time. We know there were those from Asia who were in Jerusalem at the time of Pentecost. It's likely that when Paul was in Ephesus, as we had discussed last night with Josh, that there were those who would have gone up north to Smyrna, likely founded the church there at that point in time. And one of the things that we do know in verse 9, it does talk about they're in poverty. In fact, Smyrna, as we had mentioned, was a very prosperous city, but yet the Christians there were poor. And the word that's used there for poverty, there's two different words that can be used for poverty. One would be just if you not possessing anything that's luxurious or superfluous. But there's another word, patochia, I think is how you pronounce it, the Greek word. And that means beggary or indigence. I don't know. You know what I'm saying. They were super poor. I had done it earlier in my head, and that didn't work out here. But anyway, it's the indigent. That's what I was looking for. So extremely, extremely poor, impoverished. Really, really didn't have almost anything. So they were suffering a lot of economic persecution because they were not loyal to Rome. So they were held out of different jobs. They had a lot of their possessions taken from them. So it was a very difficult time, very difficult to be a Christian there in Smyrna itself. Okay, a little bit of the overview of the message to the church in Smyrna. Is we have here that it's in verse 8, the first and the last who was dead and has come to life. In some ways, that would be an encouragement, I think, to those in Smyrna, that they were probably feeling like they were on the verge of death. They were oppressed so much, and to know that there was somebody who had life and can give life who was be addressing this to them. But they were under an incredible amount of tribulation. In this case, the word here for tribulation literally means pressure or compression. So they had a lot of pressure that was on them. It was a very, as I mentioned, a very difficult time. So it was these very distressing circumstances, trials, afflictions that were going on. So Christ understood. He knew that they were going through this tribulation, and yet he could also know what it was like to go through that type of tribulation and that type of poverty himself. He didn't have a home. He didn't have possessions. So he understood what it was like to be oppressed, to have those who were coming down on you, who were coming against you. So he knew that they were going through that, but he himself had gone through that as well. So he understood both ways. But he also told them that they are rich. That had to be encouraging to know that there was a richness that was there. And of course, that was not a physical richness that they had and not through any possessions. But it was the spiritual richness that they had, that they were storing up their treasures in heaven, the things that were going to be for them in the next life to come. And that was something that they would have to concentrate on and have to think about, given the amount of persecution and difficulty that they had at the time. And despite having that difficulty, the persecution, the tribulation that they were overcoming, verse 10, they're told not to fear, and they're going to get more. So there's already some suffering, some difficulty, some tribulation, but behold, in verse 10, the devil's about to cast some of you into prison so you'll be tested and then have tribulation for 10 days. So they're going to be cast into prison. Of course, prison at that point in time wasn't a way to try to rehabilitate somebody and get them back on their feet so they could be a useful member of society. Prison was somewhere that you were going to go and just wait to be ultimately executed in a usually a horrific type of way. So when you're going to prison, it wasn't just doing your time until you got out. It was you were going to prison, and that was likely going to be the end. You were going to be executed. And he mentions the tribulation for 10 days. And if we think back to last night when we have, looking at literal versus figurative, there's the figurative language that's used. So it's not a literal. They're going to have 10 days of being in prison or 10 days of suffering that's going to happen. There's typically 10 means something that's complete. So a complete tribulation or suffering that's going to be coming to them. Barclay had written that for a man to become a Christian anywhere was to become an outlaw, especially at this time. But he wrote, in Smyrna, above all places, for a man to enter the church was literally to take his life in his hands. It was that difficult of a time. But he does tell them that if they're faithful until death, that they're going to receive this crown of life. In this case, it's not a crown that a king would wear necessarily, but it's more of the trophy. So you get a crown, you get a trophy, that the wreath that you would get on your head for winning a race. Stephanos, what's used in this case. So they're going to have this trophy, this crown that's waiting for them if they're faithful. Stephanos was also something that was used that would be worn at special celebrations, so even at weddings. So think of Christ and his bride, the church, that you're receiving this crown that could be worn at a celebration when you're united with Christ. It was also said that a crown could be something that would have a lot of meaning to those who are in Smyrna at the time as well. As we mentioned, it was this ornament of Asia. So they had a lot of crowns in the city that were these beautiful buildings that were around that were referred to as crowns. Often those who worship pagan gods would wear crowns themselves. So now the Christians are going to get this everlasting crown that they were going to have, unlike the pagans who were worshiping the false gods with the crowns that they were wearing. And at times in that culture, we know athletes would get crowns if they won a race. Of course, those would be wreaths that would be perishable. And sometimes citizens, if for doing a good deed or doing something important, might have gotten a crown as well. But again, those were things that were fleeting and were perishing. But the those in, at the church in Smyrna would be receiving this this crown of life. So some of the, I guess I probably put this in like too much of a book report fashion, key findings. It's, maybe it seems a little bit too formal, but what's the message to those in Smyrna? So Christ spoke of the church in favorable terms, or at least he wasn't telling them they did something wrong or needed to necessarily make a correction. So there was nothing that was negative that was said about this church, and yet they're still going to suffer. So there's nothing that they're necessarily doing wrong, but they're going to have this suffering that's coming upon them. And they're going to have even more difficulties coming up, again, even though they're already having to undergo suffering. But it's helpful to know that all trials are temporary, even our lives are temporary. We're yet but a vapor in the grand scheme of things. So these trials are going to be temporary until they get this crown of life. As we mentioned before, they are rich. So Christ has told them that they should consider themselves to be rich because they are faithful to him, and they're going to have the spiritual blessings that those who are persecuting them do not, and those that are causing them to suffer do not. And then finally, he exhorted them to be steadfast in their faith, and that they would then receive this imperishable crown of life. So we're told in 1 Corinthians 9, 24 and 25, where Paul says there, "Do you not know that those who run a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable." In 2 Timothy, he says there, "I have fought the good fight, finished the course. I have kept the faith. In the future, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, not only to me, but also to all those who have loved his appearing." And then in 1 Peter 5, 4, Peter says, "And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory." Okay. So with those things in mind, what are some things for us to be thinking about ourselves? First, what the application for us is, those who obey Christ will suffer. We know that. Even if we're already in a difficult situation, if we're destitute, if we're down on our luck, that's not going to necessarily keep us from suffering. That suffering is still can and often will happen. And we'll suffer unjustly. The Christians at the time in Smyrna weren't doing anything. They were obeying God. They were doing things that were not right according to Roman emperors and the Roman rule. They weren't bowing down before the emperor and worshiping the emperor. But they weren't doing anything, doing anything that was against God's will. And so something for us to think about is implications for us if, are we really suffering? Are we, have we suffered in our lives? If those who obey Christ will suffer, are we as faithful as we should be, or doing the things that we should be, and knowing that those things would be happening to us? And when we do suffer, we have to be able to have the right attitude. Those in Smyrna were told they were going to get the crown of life, that they were rich. So they would have had, I guess I'll make a implication, that they would have had to have a positive attitude about the suffering and knowing that there was going to be something that was going to be rewarded for them. So for us, when we are suffering and thinking about the things that are impacting us, we can recall various scriptures, two of them that I'll reference here. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says in Matthew 5, starting in verse 11, "Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." And James writes at the beginning of his book or letter, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect results, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." And then we're all rich in Christ. No matter what our lot in life is, we are all can be rich with things that are spiritual, things that can fill us up from that perspective. We can should learn to be content with the things that we have, as Paul had done many times. And he talked in Philippians about he had learned to be content with whatever situation that he found himself in, because he knew that ultimately, it was Christ who was giving that strength when he needed it, when he knew that he could do all things through him and could live however Christ live a life in any way that he needed, just so he could in whatever he needed to do to serve the Lord. A couple of things to as I wrap up my time. That we need to be committed to remaining faithful until death. So no matter what happens, we need to be faithful, just as those in Smyrna would have had to have been. Looking at 2 Corinthians there in the 4th chapter, Paul writes, "But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, so that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not from ourselves. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not despairing. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our body. For we who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death works in us, but life in you. But having the same spirit of faith according to what is written, 'I believe, therefore I spoke,' we also believe, therefore we also speak, knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and will present us with you. For all things are for your sake, so that the grace which is spreading to more and more people may cause the giving of thanks to abound to the glory of God. Therefore, we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For things which are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal." And then finally, I wanted to wrap up with, an example or story from Polycarp, who was a student of John, the apostle, and was at the church in Smyrna. As it's written here, on Saturday, February 23rd in AD 155, a faithful aged leader in the church of Smyrna named Polycarp, a student of John the apostle, was martyred. It was the time of the public games and the people were excited. As it often occurs, the crowd was becoming out of hand when someone yelled out, "Away with the atheist, let Polycarp be searched for." His whereabouts were betrayed by a slave who collapsed under torture. When the police went to the location to make the arrest, Polycarp offered them a meal. As they were hauling him to the stadium, the police captain pled with the old man, "What harm is it to say Caesar is Lord and to offer sacrifice and be saved?" But Polycarp was adamant in his stand that Jesus is the only Lord. He was led into the Colosseum, which was filled with an angry mob, and before all was given the choice to call Caesar Lord or die. The proconsul threatened to burn him at the stake, to which his response was this: 86 years have I served him, that is God, and he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me? You threaten me with fire that burns for a time and is quickly quenched, for you do not know the fire that awaits the wicked in the judgment to come and in the everlasting punishment. Why are you waiting? Come, do what you will. With that refusal, Polycarp was ordered to be tied to a stake in the Colosseum and burned alive. Even though it was the Sabbath, the Jews had no problem being the primary haulers of the wood to fuel the fire. Before the fire could finish the job, the executioner pulled out his sword and stabbed him to death. This great leader who studied the feet of John the Apostle was faithful unto death. It's truly an amazing story. And to think that this was 60 years or so after this letter was written, and so the persecution and the difficulty wasn't limited to that amount of time. That was happening for years after that. So it's a commendation to that church for staying strong and being able to put up with that the persecution that was difficult and continuing. So for us, if we have ears, let us hear. And we have no persecution compared to what happened then. And let us be use the fact that we have not the same amount of persecution to be bold in our faith, and to seek for ways in which we can better serve our God.